Hey everybody, it is time. It is time to hop on a plane, a train, a boat, a goat, a bike, a car, and find your way upstate New York to a little town outside of Phoenicia. I don't know what the town's called actually, but the place that we're going to be in is called Menla, and it is a gorgeous, epic retreat center in the middle of the forest in the Catskill Mountains with a spa and organic vegetarian food with lots of beans and yoga in the morning and a swimming pool and a swimming hole and trails. And yes, it is an HLN retreat. It is a 5-day retreat from Wednesday, June 12th to Sunday, June 16th. It is the biggest retreat we've ever put on, and the entire team is going to be there. They are all flying from different corners of the country to come together to hold you in the healing magic that is Somatics. We will be teaching you how to belong without having to fit in, how to find safety inside of yourself and share that with others, how to receive witnessing, how to feel for your boundaries instead of fawning. We are going to cover so much, and you're going to be doing it in the most ideal setting of being fed, of being loved, of resting, of enjoying the forest and nature, and being with us and 60 other bodies. So please go to the website, holisticlifenavigation.com, and click on events, and you'll find it there. Wednesday, June 12th to Sunday, June 16th. All the info as well can be found directly through the link in this episode details. I am just so thrilled for this, and I can't wait to see some of you in person. Welcome to the Holistic Life Navigation Podcast. I am your host, Luis Mujica. I was sick and depressed until I discovered that I could make music, and then my whole life transformed because I began learning how to listen more deeply. Listen to life, to the people around me, and to my body. And that's when I realized that the body speaks through sensations, and learning this new language meant relearning my body and mind. I soon healed myself of many chronic conditions and then began teaching others how to do so as well. Holistic Life Navigation combines nutrition, self-inquiry, and somatic experiencing to help you release stress and trauma just by listening to your own body. This podcast serves as a place to share my experiences, as well as the experiences of many others who have healed and are healing through unique, unorthodox, and unusual ways. Your time to learn begins now. Today, I wanted to talk about empathy, a very confusing word, but a really powerful way to live. The one thing I have learned from all my years as a human with clients and having had conversations with many different people is that those who have empathy will suffer much less. This is different from the empath. Let's speak about the empath first. The empath is someone who feels everything, whereas having empathy is the experience of understanding someone. Empaths don't necessarily understand other people. Some do, but the physiology of an empath is essentially a body that is so heightened that the nervous system is reaching out to touch everything around it, experiencing sensations, temperatures, smells, sounds, and textures in a way that can be overwhelming and literally nauseating. The empath is also constantly experiencing somatic empathy, which means what I see you going through, I feel. This doesn't even always mean they're accurately feeling the other individual's experience, but rather their nervous system instantaneously and powerfully replicates what is being imagined or what they're imagining as they're witnessing a person. So if I see someone looking sad, my body will become overwhelmed with sadness and pain and a heaviness
that might be hard for me to even climb out of. Yet that sad person may just be thinking deeply, for all I know. Being an empath doesn't always mean being psychic, but some empaths do have an incredible ability to feel someone else's energy and know what it means. Someone's guilt, someone's shame, someone's trauma. For the empath, this is a constant boundary break. Every time the nervous system mirrors another person's experience, or imagines it, the body is flooded with overwhelm. That overwhelm in response to another person can be experienced as a threat because it's so powerful. And not as a threat like someone will hurt you, but as a threat because such overwhelming force comes over the body in response to other individuals and how they look or smell or talk or act. Simply put, being an empath can be traumatizing on a daily basis. But how did the empath become so porous, so able to sense out energies, sometimes even preventing a disaster? I believe childhood trauma. Especially when the childhood traumatic events were repetitive with lots of space in between. For example, consider someone who lived with an explosive parent. A parent who out of the blue would verbally or physically become violent, aggressive, or dominating. The child of that parent would naturally begin developing a hypervigilance in their nervous systems so that they could feel out into the room to see if today was going to be a good or bad day. Children of alcoholics will especially relate to this. When a parent is unstable, bipolar, abusive, depressive, essentially having any experience where they suddenly shift into a role that is abusive or scary or neglecting or vacant, a role that's suddenly overwhelming. The child of that parent will develop traits of an empath, traits of hypervigilance, feeling into rooms, reading into behaviors and even gestures of that person, and they will do this all by themselves through their nervous system. So as that child develops, their nervous systems become porous, like sponges, constantly picking up on everything around them for survival. Why do you think traditionally superheroes always have some background story of trauma and abuse and near death? Because there's a lot of wisdom. There's a lot of skill. There's a lot that we develop from consistent, prevalent trauma. That doesn't mean being an empath as a result of childhood trauma makes it no less of a gift or a superpower. It certainly is, but it's working against you until your body learns how to be with it. Healing the body so that we can shift from empath to empathetic is the way to become more balanced in our experience of others in the world. And being empathic is a major superpower, which I'll explain in a little bit. But first, the empath has to start by showing their bodies that they're safe. Using that powerful sense to feel the room and start retraining their body and mind to feel for the good, the safe, and the stable, because they're in the habit of feeling for the bad, the sad, the suffering, the overwhelming. And when I say the habit, I never mean the person, I mean the nervous system. This is an innocent, unconscious experience happening. And even in opposition to what I just said, feeling the good sometimes is too overwhelming for the empath as well, because the nervous system can't handle any charge, whether it's a charge of joy or a charge of fear. So to begin grounding what we feel in a more neutral way may resonate for some of you listening. So right now, just pause. Or come back to this if you're driving and unable to focus at the moment. All you have to do is find one thing where you are right now that your body can experience as pleasant. Not stimulating or overly enriching or activating or overwhelming, but pleasant, simple, neutral. A tree, a window, the sky, your clothing on your skin, music, the smell of good food, a painting, a pet, anything that lets you breathe a little bit deeper, anything that softens a part of your body, anything that creates a feeling of safety in you. Then focus on where the feeling is in the body and breathe into it. Give it permission to expand and see what it does. Does it expand through your body? Does it stay small? Does it come or go? What you're doing here is no small task. Even though it seems very simple, you're actually redirecting how your body experiences the world. You see, the untrained empath is in a constant state of bracing against the world, feeling overwhelmed by the world, and even feeling attacked by the world. So allowing your body to feel comforted by the world, safe by the world, and secure by the world is huge. We want to build this practice every moment we can remember to, and then we end up building the capacity in our nervous systems to feel safety, which then will dilute all the fear and panic. When that happens, we begin to feel more regulated, and we learn how to self-regulate. This is what we didn't have in childhood. This state of regulation and safety reduces the charge that's always running through the nervous system, allowing the body to breathe more deeply, sleep more deeply, digest better, and build an actual boundary that is your body, so that your mind and body can say, "That's your experience, not mine." And it doesn't say it in a rude way, or a privileged way, or a demeaning way. It says it in the way of reality. That's you over there. This is me right here. And that statement is the ultimate boundary for the empath to achieve. What's yours and what's mine? So when you practice this enough, you may hop on a train or go to the office or see your family, and you'll feel that charge coming up into your body around certain people and environments. But you'll know not to blame the charge on anyone there. Instead, you'll know how to ground the charge by finding what's safe in the room or in you. And from that safety comes a clarity that says, "My heart is racing because I see my mom's anxiety, but it's hers and not mine." And the body will remember itself again and slowly regulate. This is a practice, and the empath has a great ability to connect and help people on many levels from their own experiences of pain and suffering. I'm a recovering empath. I went through many years of avoiding people completely because my body couldn't handle being around them. Now I'm able to work somatically with my clients and say things like, "I feel something in my stomach. It feels like fear. Does that resonate for you?" Then they might say, "Why, yes, it does," or, "Nope, doesn't." So I'm at this place where I honor what comes up with a question, not a certainty that I know that. Even if I'm picking up on what someone else is feeling, I still don't have to feel it. My nervous system has been practicing for over 5 years now and knows how to quickly reconnect to itself or something safe to find grounding. Now, some of you may be thinking, "I was born this way. It's my gift. Nothing bad happened in my childhood." I would say that you're absolutely correct. Some of you were born this way, and it is a gift, and not because of childhood, but because of childbirth. What was your birth like? Better yet, what were your mother's second and third trimesters like? Mark Wolin explains intergenerational trauma very poignantly in his book, It Didn't Start With You. The book is about intergenerational trauma and how we physically take on trauma memories in our bodies, behaviors, and even physiology, how we hold our bodies, based on our parents and grandparents and ancestors. When a woman hits 10 weeks of pregnancy of gestation, right around the time of the third trimester, the developing fetus, if female, will have all of her eggs. This means, as Mark writes in his book, that from 10 weeks until birth, there are three people sharing one body: the mother, the fetus, and the next generation in her eggs. The same is true for a male fetus. The cells in his sex organs will develop into sperm cells during puberty, but still, those cells are in his body by the end of the first trimester. This is important because the developing fetus is being bathed by hormones that are telling it what to expect in the outside world. Is it pleasant out there, or is it dangerous out there? This is all being determined through hormones like adrenaline. One way that scientists have discovered intergenerational trauma to be a fact is by testing babies born from mothers who survived 9/11. It was found that those babies had a huge drop in cortisol levels, which would actually suggest adrenal fatigue. Why? Because their bodies were experiencing panic in the womb. By the time they were born, again, including how they were born, their bodies were already in a hypervigilant post-traumatic stress response. Because, again, they had been conditioned in the womb by the stress hormones from their mother to expect threat. So that's how we can be born with trauma in our bodies before anything even happens outside of the womb. Now, the first few weeks and months and years are really critical as well. These are preverbal years, especially before 2 years old, even some people say up until 7 years old, because our explicit memories get stronger and stronger as we hit age seven. Everything else is just remembered in the body, or there's little snapshots, but real memory develops deeper as you get older. I've worked with a lot of empaths who are separated from their parents soon after delivery due to medical reasons, or their mother had to go to work and so they were placed in daycare very early. Any situation that causes the child not to have their primary caregiver 24/7 for the first several years even can cause a stress response and even traumatic response in the nervous system. This doesn't mean that there's abuse. This doesn't mean that the parent is neglectful. If a mother has to go to work, she has to go to work. She's doing a responsible thing. So it's not meant to shame mothers going to work. It is meant to shed light on the nervous system and how you could have a really amazing, pleasant, loving household, yet your body can have symptoms of PTSD, or you can be an empath just from experiencing that heightened charge of losing your caregiver every day. So I ask you to look further into your past, all the way into the womb, and ask your parents and the people around you what life was like then. This will give your mind and body context to also use that earlier statement of, this isn't mine. My mother was stressed during pregnancy, and that was her stress, not mine. And feel for the difference of what she had gone through versus what you were going through. And if you connect to stressful or traumatic events that happened in the first couple years, you can say, that happened, and now I'm safe, and look for proof that you're safe now, and feel that. What we're trying to do is update the body to a place of safety. And before we move on from the empath, I just want to say that I'm not here to strip away the identity of the empath. Many people have proclaimed, you know, I'm an empath, hear me roar. And I think that's great, actually, you know, because empaths tend to be very introverted. I think it's a great thing to take it by the horns and have this wonderful power and be an empath coach and an empath therapist and all these things. My perspective I'm trying to offer is that being an empath, and also I guess being a highly sensitive person, HSP, their responses to unprocessed trauma, their expressions of unprocessed trauma, that's really how I see them. And when I call myself a recovering empath, I mean that I once identified as an empath because I remember those feelings and living that way for years. And then the more trauma work I did and the more somatic trauma healing I did, the less I experienced the symptoms of being an empath. And the same has been true for many people I've worked with. So there's definitely exceptions, but in my little world and in my experience, being an empath and being a highly sensitive person is something we can actually manage and transform through trauma healing when we work with the body. Because empath and HSP is a nervous system experience. It is not in your mind. You are not making it up. It is in your body, and there's nothing you can do about it. And that's why it feels so overwhelming. Well, there's something you can do about it, but what I'm trying to say is you're not doing it. You're not in control of it. And that's why we get overwhelmed by it, because we're being bombarded with information everywhere that overwhelms our systems. So by doing somatic therapy and somatic-based therapies, you're able to build that deep resilience in the nervous system. So when information comes in, it doesn't overwhelm you as much. And like I said, when we update the body to a place of safety, hypervigilant tendencies go away, and our nervous systems don't go outwards for information as much. They kind of just hang out close to our bodies. And that feeds and nourishes us and gives us vitality. So moving on from the empath into having empathy. Remember, being an empath is feeling everything and everyone's state, whereas being empathic or having empathy means understanding everyone's state. Now, this gets controversial because we're expected to hate the bad guys, or else you are the bad guy, or else you agree with the bad guy, or else you condone the bad guy, or else you'll do nothing to stop the bad guy. And I just so lovingly disagree with that. First, what happens in the body when you hate? Really notice. We call it empowered sometimes to hate or have a lot of anger or rage towards someone. But what if what we're calling power or empowered is actually overwhelm, a state of heightened activation from threat and excitement and terror? This is what I've come to find in myself and in every single person I've worked with. Yes, every single person. At the root of their empowering hatred or anger or rage is extreme discomfort, bracing, feeling threatened, and a deep sadness. I have to say, I have to put a pin in this for a minute. Having a fight or flight response to a threat is a healthy thing. That the body's made to do that. Living in a fight or flight because you hate somebody is a different thing. That's a frozen state of a threat response versus one that you instantaneously experience, run away, yell, punch someone, push them away, whatever it is to feel safe, and then you're resolved. That's different. That you move through that. Me personally, I don't think I'd punch someone. Maybe if my life was threatened, I would consider it and then I would hold them afterwards. But it's I'm trying to understand myself and make sense for all of you that our fight responses are good. That's why we're alive and we have to honor that. It's living in the fight response. And so when you're experiencing hatred and rage and anger at somebody, you're living in a fight response and that wears down your body. So at the core of that hatred and anger, like I said, extreme discomfort, bracing, feeling threatened, and sadness. Now, why? Why do we feel these things when we're angry or have rage or have hate? There are a couple answers to that question. So first, foundationally, I truly believe we don't want to hate. I don't believe it's good for us. And how do I know? Because it doesn't feel good in the body. And our beautiful bodies are gifts in this physical world. They are barometers that we can use to feel when we're off in our thinking or our doing. Our guilt, our pain, our anger tells us when we're off. And hatred does not feel good. I believe hating someone else is hating a part of ourselves. My mind cuts to this wise woman named Mary. Mary works as a cook at this camp I go to every year. It's a pagan camp where we do ritual and heal trauma and make community very radical, sacred community space in transforming and shifting our stories and our bodies and the land we share. So at this camp, Mary is our cook, and she's this amazing Quaker woman. She has a deep love and loyalty to food and to culture and to land. She speaks different languages. She's lived all over the world. She speaks to her ingredients and they speak to her. She calls their name and they respond. She's like a food shaman. And she always says, as we're lining up to get our food, "Now remember, everyone, one day you will be the person behind you in line." And everybody laughs because it's true. So at our core, we are all capable of what we like to call good and evil. Me personally, I don't believe in evil. Instead, I believe in unconsciously traumatized or consciously traumatized, unconsciously acting or consciously acting. You're either aware of what your mind is thinking, what your body's doing, or you're not. Those of us who are aware do not consciously inflict pain or react from our beliefs and sudden thoughts. Those of us who are unaware most likely do. So hating someone who does something wrong is just hating a part of yourself, the part of yourself that is out of control, mentally ill, abused, or completely gone. Why else would it feel bad in our bodies? Because the person is bad? Remember earlier? This is not mine. Someone's wrongdoing is for them to feel, not for me. And this is the beginning of having unconditional empathy for people. The second reason I believe it feels bad to hate is because of the physiology of hate. The body has to constrict. The blood pressure rises. The heart rate increases. And the expansive, loving mind shrinks into the survival brain of judgment and fear. That means adrenaline. That means inflammation, poor posture. All of that makes up the physiology of hatred. How do we cope with our hatred? What do we watch? What do we eat? What do we talk about? What are we addicted to? How do we treat our bodies, and how do we treat the people around us? My third reason of why it feels bad to hate begins with a quote from Cornel West. He says, "You don't begin dehumanizing those who are dehumanizing you, because it contributes to the cycle of dehumanization in the world." I'm going to say it again. You don't begin dehumanizing those who are dehumanizing you, because it contributes to the cycle of dehumanization in the world. So every time we hate someone, usually because they are doing, saying, or believing things that come from their own hatred, you are just hating another person. You're just another person hating. Forget the cause, it's still hate. And it only perpetuates more hate. Does this mean that we don't try people or put them in prison or call the cops if someone's harassing us? Of course we do all those things. Putting someone in prison doesn't mean you have to dehumanize the person. And that's going to be a whole other podcast for another time about compassionate prisons and how we can get closer to that in our country. But for the individual listening to this, for the individual mind, you can have boundaries, and you can also have order, and you can also give people consequences for their behavior and at the same time see them as a human. So what about anger? Now, what's wrong with anger? Absolutely nothing. Anger is essential because it is our body telling us that our boundaries have been broken. Identifying with anger and reacting with anger, as well as living in that fixed state of anger I spoke of earlier, that's what hurts us. Anger is a reminder. It's an invitation, a sensory invitation to go inside and ask, what do I need right now? Instead, our egos tend to grab the anger and try to look out into the world and prove all the reasons why we should be angry. And what happens? We actually become disembodied because we leave ourselves. We become so overwhelmed with anger that it becomes rage, that we just dissociate. Dissociation is when our consciousness goes somewhere else. We just take off, black out, forget a sequence of time, see ourselves from the other side of the room, or as if we're hovering above ourselves. This is what happens when we're experiencing trauma, when so much overwhelming energy goes beyond our body's capacity to hold it. So being angry, rageful, and reactive can be the most disempowering ways to inhabit our bodies, our minds, and our lives. I know I am out of control and my body is too overwhelmed if I'm in a state, fixed state of anger that isn't moving. However, listening to my anger is really powerful. And the more we listen to it, the more we learn how to feel for it. Feel when the stomach clenches, when the jaw tightens, when the forehead constricts. These are the very early signs that something is off. A boundary is broken, and I am overwhelmed. Learning how to listen to your body is the foundation of my work. I teach a 4-week course 2 or 3 times a year on this and invite anyone listening to sign up for the waitlist. The next course is in March 2021. You can go to my website and click the online course tab, and it will teach you all about listening and feeling and responding to our bodies so that we can free ourselves from stress and trauma. Once we practice this work, we begin to find more safety and trust in ourselves because we learn how to release overwhelm just by using our bodies and our minds. Nutrition is also really helpful medicine, as is herbal therapy, and sometimes that's the best place to begin. Still, I've learned that once we maintain the practice of self-regulation, which is really just creating safety within and for yourself, empathy comes really naturally and easily. Why? Because we're no longer physically affected by somebody else. And if you are, it's on such a smaller level that you can still think clearly enough to take care of yourself instead of reacting and losing yourself or breaking all of your boundaries for the other person and against yourself. This means that anyone can do or say anything, and while you don't agree with them, your body remains safe. Your blood pressure doesn't rise. Your breathing doesn't get shallow. Your heart stays calm and your mind stays calm. This doesn't mean you sit back and watch injustice. I've worked with so many people who are in abusive relationships and very dangerous situations. I've seen animals being abused. I've seen people having crisis right before me. And I don't just say, well, I don't feel it, so not my problem. I attend. I show up. I facilitate. I listen. I make phone calls. I call police. I give people rides. I'm all about serving someone to heal and be saved from a potentially or dangerous situation. And the difference is I don't do it with hatred or anger. I do it with empathy. So as I see the man abusing his wife, I understand why he does that. And that actually helps me be more clear with her and to be able to say, this isn't for you to fix. This isn't your life to fix. This is his life to fix. What keeps you there? And what keeps people in abusive relationships and what keeps people watching injustice and not doing anything about it, what keeps people silent with violence isn't because they're empathic. It's because they're scared, because they don't understand. And I get that. I've been scared. I've been too afraid to speak up. I've watched somebody yelling at someone in the street and I didn't get involved. So there's a time and a place, as we know, to get involved. But my point here is I don't believe anyone in history has ever allowed something horrible to happen because they were so empathic. It's usually the other way around. It's because they're so numb or they're so scared. And remember, numb and dissociation comes from overwhelm. Empathic takes away the overwhelm. So if anything, you're going to think much more clearly. I remember actually a year or so after doing this work that I do for others, when I started doing it with myself very deeply, I got to this beautiful place of fearlessness. I don't always maintain that, but I remember really being deep in that. And I was at a retreat. And we were in a monastery and we were all in a circle. There's maybe 50 of us. And we were singing, we were humming, we were making beautiful kind of guttural sounds. And an elderly man put his finger to the sky, almost like pointing to the sky. And it was as if he had gotten struck by lightning. He didn't. We were inside, but it looked like it. And what it was a seizure. And he started whimpering and a noise came out of his mouth, very primal noise. And his whole body started seizing. And he fell into the arms of this woman in shock next to him who just froze with her arms out. He fell right into them very perfectly. And I remember my body didn't get triggered, which was rare for me. Usually I would really take on someone's physical state and I would be paralyzed by it, kind of like the girl who accidentally saved his life by breaking his fall in her frozen, beautiful frozen arms. But my body just floated toward him. I remember this amazing, and I say floated because I didn't really think about it. It just went. It just served, walked right up to him without any fear. And I held his legs and I patted his legs and I hummed to him. And we all, maybe three or four of us, gathered around him and we were just with him. And those of us that were gathered around him, we didn't have much fear. We just loved him. We didn't even know him, but we wanted to be there for him. That's what it's like to have empathy. And The controversial piece about empathy is the word unconditional when you put it before empathy. Unconditional empathy means I don't dole it out to this person and not that person. Everyone gets it. And if I am, if I was a police officer and I was handcuffing someone who just committed a crime, I would handcuff them with empathy. I wouldn't spit on them or yell at them or kick them or threaten them. I would just be sending them so much love as I hold their hands and cuff them. It'd be an opportunity for intimacy. And that sounds crazy for some people. And for some of you, it sounds exactly like what you would do. But I'm trying to put this word unconditional empathy into perspective. Okay? Because when we're in this calm, clear place, that place is the necessary requirement for living a life of empathy. Because for me to understand someone and have any kind of response to them that is helpful, I have to feel safe in myself first. Otherwise, I'm going to react. And then you just have two people reacting out onto one another. And they both think that they're justified in their reactions. And that gets us nowhere. So if someone commits a horribly violent crime, I never once question if that person should be put in jail or tried for their crimes. I believe it's the kindest thing to do for them and for the society, so they don't keep hurting themselves unconsciously by hurting others, and so others don't get hurt. That being said, my very open mind right now wants me to question everything I hear. It makes me want to empathize with everyone in this scenario. I want to understand the victim and their family. I want to understand the perpetrator and their family. I want to understand the court system. I don't want the prison system to dehumanize the person who committed the crime, guilty or innocent. Why? Because of everything I've already said. If someone is at the place in their mind and body where they would kill or hurt someone consciously or unconsciously for that matter, that person is in dire need of help. They don't need more violence. Why add more violence to something so violent already? And if the guards and the media and the society watching on pummels them with literal or metaphorical stones, then those people pummeling the villain are the new villain. We've just shifted to a different demographic. We cannot align with the energies of things, which we hope to shift and heal. We're just adding more of what we say we don't want in our world. We're becoming the thing we're fighting against. However, like the magic nervous system, we can build the capacity to love and understand and dilute violence through empathy. Empathy is the way. Think of all the people throughout our country's recent history, like the past 30 years, who have been unjustly incarcerated and traumatized from their experience of being publicly shamed and dismissed, of being dehumanized in the prison system. And when finally free, they've either been made into criminals from the violence thrusted upon them, or they end their lives because they can't even function in the world. And I'm talking innocent people wrongly convicted. So how do you know who to convict? How do you know who's wrong? Why agree with the population that says this is right or wrong? With empathy, right or wrong isn't what you're looking for, because it doesn't decide how you treat someone. You treat them the same. Again, are there consequences? Yes. But do you respect and treat them with kindness? Yes. Why? Because they might be innocent. And let's say they're not. They're still human. And if you stop feeling love and respect and empathy for another human being, then you have just dehumanized yourself. So if we think for ourselves, think right now of a time you publicly shamed or joined in shaming someone. I see it right now and it brings tears to my eyes. It's the fifth grade and I'm on the school bus and everyone is making fun of a girl's nose. And I join in, because it's the first time ever that a group of boys have accepted me. So there's a confusion in my 10-year-old brain. This feels good to be accepted, and it feels good to project my own self-hate, my own anger and rage from being bullied onto this girl. And to this day, tears come. And sometimes I cry because the pain it causes to hate or hurt someone is undeniable when you get really still and let yourself feel it. I've forgiven that 10-year-old boy who did that. Yet the pain, ooh, I can feel it. It's amazing. And I'm thankful for it. Because just like the anger, that pain tells me something's off. This isn't you. And being able to go there to that bus, I can feel the disembodiment. I can feel the high of acceptance, of the mob. I can feel the release of adrenaline that had nowhere to go from years of bullying, sexual assault. I can get in touch with the brute in me that wanted to tear that poor girl apart because I felt so torn apart. So how could I ever judge another human being for wanting to or actually hurt somebody? I am that human being. We all are. And we are so much more as well. Capable of transforming and healing and releasing and forgiving. I know how good my heart is. And I know what it's like for a heart to be misled by desperation and confusion and rage. And in that confusion, there's an innocence so controversial and hard to understand at first. And it is from that place that we do what people call bad things. So if you're still with me on this episode, I thank you. If this is angering you or triggering you, causing you to feel something, feel it. Be with it. That thing you feel is a part of you that's trying to talk to you. And any parts of ourselves that we have denied will always present themselves through others. So through our empathy, we can love and understand others, and thereby love and understand unseen, unknown, and even unforgiven parts of ourselves. And we don't just say, I love and understand you. We must work at it. We must really listen to the people we don't like and try to understand why they believe what they believe. Do our research, ask the questions, ask them questions if they're open to talking to you. Engage in respectful disagreements so we can have curiosity and learn. Because the more we learn about the other in our lives, the more we learn about ourselves. It's so easy to mistake an empathy and love for enabling and justifying and passively accepting abuse. This is the biggest concern and confusion any human has when I speak to them about unconditional empathy. And this is the foundational reason why I teach everyone to become more embodied first. The reason why embodiment is so important is because we can feel our bodies. We're in our bodies when we're embodied. So we stayed anchored to our boundaries because our bodies are our boundaries. They literally wrap around our conscious selves and encapsulate us. Feeling your body while moving with empathy is powerful. So we're not spiritually or emotionally or intellectually bypassing abusive behavior by having empathy, because empathy has nothing to do with action. It's an experience in the body. If I understand the abusive spouse, it doesn't mean I would tell someone to stay with that person. It doesn't mean that person's childhood trauma justifies the other's abuse. The total opposite has been true. By understanding their trauma and why they act how they act, I've seen people learn that it has nothing to do with them that their husband's abusive, that it's not theirs to fix. And they don't want to be married to a child who hurts them because he's hurting. So they give up and surrender the idea of sticking around to change the person. And instead, they leave with total clarity and empathy. Again, total understanding, which equals safety in their own bodies. They're free to live their own lives versus be stuck with the other person's experience. And that's the reality of embodied empathy versus bypassing reality to enable abuse and calling it empathy. That's avoidance. That's different. And I have plenty of experience of helping people, like I said, leave these situations. So I've beautifully watched people do this in an incredibly courageous and holistic manner, without hatred, without anger, with boundaries and with love and with empathy. And it's powerful. There's no reason why it can't be done everywhere. And that's because they deserve total freedom. And for me, total freedom means that they're safe in their environment and they feel safe in their bodies. The people in our lives who are most abusive and obnoxious are our teachers. That's a quote from Dr. Edith Eger, who spent an entire year in the Auschwitz concentration camp when she was 16 years old. She used her experience in Auschwitz decades later to find empathy for the guards, to find compassion for the men who killed her mother. She did this at a distance from the event itself, many years later. So as much as I believe it to be true that the most powerfully painful people in our lives are our teachers, you don't need to stay in the abusive relationship with them or situation to learn your lesson. Distance learning is far more effective and kinder to you and them. Dr. Edith has experienced that herself. Because based on what I've shared in this episode, if someone is hurting me, they're also hurting themselves on some level. If I don't want to hurt, and I don't want them to hurt, what do? I leave. I say no. I call the police. I do what it takes to protect myself while understanding them and myself. I don't bypass myself to understand them. And for most of us in codependent relationships, in a codependent society, we don't think the two can go together, boundaries and love. But remember, boundaries mean your body, your needs, your truth. Love means a deep feeling of affection. Empathy means understanding someone's suffering. None of those are actions. They're just experiences. So having a boundary while saying I love you is a holistic, complete experience and response to situations. And don't take my word for it. Test it out. Feel it in your own body. Notice when you have empathy, how do you feel? Notice when you judge, shame, or hate someone, how do you feel? You deserve what's best for your body. For me, it is empathy. And that's been my radical medicine throughout this experience so far. And one thing I'll share with you, because it feels very important, is anyone that follows my work knows that I had experienced multiple accounts of sexual assault and extreme bullying. And I was actually... In the seventh grade, I had to be escorted by a teacher from classroom to classroom because I was so hated by my peers. And I remember at the time being confused. I didn't hate anybody, but it wasn't healthy because I was bypassing my anger and I was avoiding my own needs and just thinking about their own pain and why they were doing that to me. So it was a bit imbalanced. But in the past several years, I was able to go back to a lot of those situations, moments of assault, moments of being bullied, moments of, I remember someone giving me 2 quarters and saying, if I give this to you, will you kill yourself? I was so hated for being a feminized person. And so I've gone to those moments and I've worked this empathy practice of, I want to understand them. I want to understand what someone is going through who would assault somebody. And what I found in my mind and heart was such desperation, such pain, such confusion, such isolation. And I'll tell you, I had about 5 years ago, I actually looked up one of my perpetrators, I prefer to call him a human, who assaulted me. And he took his own life. And even saying that, I feel the tears well up because it confirmed for me what I had always known, But what I truly was able to experience as I became older and more mature, that all the people who had inflicted pain on me were living in such a pain that I couldn't even imagine they must have been living in. And I would never, ever accept abuse. And I would never accept someone to violate me. Yet, I would never violate myself by walking away from a situation and allowing myself to hate somebody for the rest of my life. Because for me, that would be the ultimate violence in my own heart, in my own spirit, and in my own body. I also, you know, so vividly remember the feeling of being hated. It's so in my nervous system because it was just years and years and years and years and years everywhere I went, was hated by my peers. And it's so fresh sometimes that even if I get a negative comment on social media, or if someone, you know, disagrees with me, this wound will creep up of just a visceral, painful shame like I need to hide. And I'm so blessed that I found this work because I can hold myself and within minutes actually come to life, which before would have taken months. But my point of saying that is I'll never forget what it felt like to be hated. So I don't know how in my own right conscious mind I could ever inflict that on anyone for anything. I don't want people to feel hated. People don't learn by feeling hated. And in a weird way, I'm just carrying and perpetrating their hate out into the world. So I'm doing their, quote, hateful work for them while they're behind bars or dead or living somewhere else. I rather feel love, and I rather express love, and I rather express love and empathy indiscriminately. And that's what I'm going to continue to do. So I am so excited to I can hear a child screaming and laughing outside my office. I'm so excited, just like that child is, to just share this with you, because a few paragraphs here and there weren't doing it for me in newsletters and on Instagram and such. I wanted to create a nice container for us to go into and for you to hear me and go on this journey with me. So I appreciate that you came on this journey with me. And I'll be doing more work on this in the future. And I just appreciate the courage that it can take sometimes to even listen to someone like me. So I thank you for that. And I hope you've learned just how to notice how it feels when you're holding hate or judgment or anger versus when you're holding love and empathy. If that's the only thing you walk away from this with, it's the most important thing. Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. My question for you is, where do you feel the episode? Take a breath and just notice, what's your body doing right now? Sit with it, let it speak to you, and let whatever comes up, come up. And your only job is to listen, for all the wisdom you need is right inside of you. For more information on my work, including my online courses and healing circles, please visit holisticlifenavigation.com. You can also follow me on Instagram and Facebook, where I share weekly philosophies and resources to help you release stress and trauma from your body so that you can live a happier life. Thank you so much for joining me. I'll see you next time.